Hello, this is Ken Tucker with Changescape Web. Today, I'm really excited to have Mark F. Miller here to talk about general business law and real estate law. Mark is the principal at the law offices of Mark F. Miller, LLC, and he represents small and medium-sized businesses as well as individuals. Mark earned his JD from and certificate in international and comparative law from St. Louis University Law School, where he served as a member of the Law School Ethics Committee, the Student Bar Association representative, and as an editor of the St. Louis University Law Journal. Mark's career has entailed both litigation and transactional work, and this unique background has allowed Mark to analyze clients' matters from a variety of key perspectives and offer creative solutions. I'm really excited to have you here today, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
This is a topic that I think is important for a lot of small business owners, a lot of medium-sized business owners.
Absolutely.
You and I have talked, a little bit about contracts and the importance of those and whatnot. So I guess the first thing I would like to talk to you about today is what agreements do you think are really important in the early stages of a company, and just kind of explain why you think those are.
Sure. So nowadays, the most prominently used entities are limited liability companies, or what we might call LLCs commonly, or corporations. And corporations have been around for hundreds of years, and they're a separate legal entity which can provide that limited liability and protect the owners, the shareholders, as they're called. Limited liability companies have only been around as an entity for about 20 years, but they've really become a great workhorse for the small business owner and even for medium-sized business owners. I think even the St. Louis Cardinals, I believe, are a limited liability company these days.
Okay.
So it's not just for the small business, but the LLC can also provide that limited liability that we could talk about later if you choose. But whichever entity you may choose nowadays, which those are really the bulk of the new entities, are one of those two structures. If you have a limited liability company, you're going to need what's called an operating agreement. It's the equivalent of the corporation's bylaws. And what that is, that's an agreement amongst the owners of the company, be them shareholders or what is called members for a limited liability company. And those are important, number one, to have that memorialized, what the terms of this agreement are that you and your partners are going into this business under. But it's also important that in most circumstances, at the beginning of a business, there's not going to be any money to cause disruptions and fights. So if you can't agree on the terms of your business at the outset, when there's nothing to fight over, it's going to get all the more complicated when there is hopefully money to be concerned about and assets to be concerned about.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So, the operating agreement and the bylaws typically address similar issues. Who are the members or the shareholders? How much do they own relative to the company? How much of the equity? How much of the equity is going to be withheld for future members? What are the voting rights of those persons, the shareholders or the members? What are the terms under which a new member can be brought in? What kind of vote is needed to pass a certain issue that comes up before them, be it merging with another company or making a substantial purchase? Does it need to be a simple majority or super majority or even a unanimous decision? Those are the sorts of things that need to be included in those documents.
Okay.
And again, if you can't agree on those items at the very outset, it probably doesn't bode well for your future dealings with each other.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess one thing that comes to my mind then is, so what if you're a single owner of a company? Would you still want to have an LLC or even be a corporation? And maybe, I think I know the answer, but do corporations or certain organizational structures legally provide protection from the individual versus the company?
Well, I would answer that no person should want to be engaged in their business as a sole proprietor. The startup cost to get your business organized with the Missouri Secretary of State, whatever state you may be in, is very minimal compared to the risk that you're running without having that corporate or LLC shield in front of you. So you don't want to necessarily stay as a sole proprietor, even if you are a solo. I myself am a solo, but I still have my LLC set up and I've got my operating agreement. And it's quite simple to do that. But the reason you want that entity set up is because when you set up a corporation or a limited liability company, it can be looked at as a contract with the state of Missouri that you, state, will give me limited liability in exchange for me doing certain things that I need to do, such as not using the corporation or the LLC to commit fraud. Think of what is often called the storm chasers who follow the tornadoes, mm-hmm. you know, often through the South and say, give me $5,000 today, Grandma, and I'll come back and fix your siding, and they never come back. Even though they have a corporate entity, they're still committing fraud with it. That's not permitted, obviously. Commingling personal and business funds. You know, you can't take the family to Disney World on the corporate dime and call it a business expense. That's improper. With a corporation, you need to have annual meetings of the shareholders and the directors. Limited liability companies, you do not need to have those annual meetings, but I always recommend that my clients do that just for the sake of being thorough and keeping a good record, which will only help them in the event of an audit or if somebody is looking at purchasing them. If they follow those items and others, which are called the corporate formalities, the state will provide them that limited liability, which means if the company is sued and there's not enough assets in the company, be it the bank account or solid assets, mm-hmm. tangible assets such as real estate or maybe a fleet of trucks, if there's not enough assets to satisfy that judgment, oftentimes a plaintiff's attorney will ask the court to do what's called pierce the corporate veil, which means they want to get directly to the individual owner's assets, you know, their family bank account. And if a person has satisfied all those corporate formalities, they will not be, a plaintiff's counsel will not be allowed to pierce the corporate veil.
Okay.
And that's where that shield of limited liability comes in. It doesn't mean you can get off from not paying your loans back or anything like that.
That's very helpful. I'd heard the phrase piercing the corporate veil quite a bit. Had an idea of what it meant as a business owner, you know, but that's when I started my company back in 2005. That's been a long time ago, so it's always good to be reminded of that. I mean, I certainly would encourage anybody to have a conversation with a business attorney on a regular basis, just to validate what you're doing and make sure that it's still on track and accurate.
It's kind of like going to the doctor and getting an update or a physical.
Absolutely.
It doesn't hurt to make sure you're on the right track. And to use your terminology, if the attorney validates what you're doing, then you can sleep a little bit more comfortably. If he says you're on the wrong track, then you know, perhaps change course a little bit or change your practices.
So that really sounds like it's really talking about a lot of the things that you need to do and think about when you first get a business entity or a company up and running. What about the types of agreements you need to have after you've established your business?
Sure. So after that, you know, after you kind of have your name and your brand and you know where you want to go and you've worked things out amongst your partners, hopefully you're going to be selling something, be it a service or a tangible item, a widget, whatever that might be. So you're going to be dealing with the public on a regular basis in most circumstances. You're going to need a contract that is specifically tailored for your business and your needs, because that's going to be used over and over and over, hopefully, with each of your customers. And since the repetition of use is so great, the likelihood of there being an issue that's going to be interpreting that contract is increased. So you want a contract that protects you, yet is still fair. You don't want it so one-sided that a court would throw it out and say, this is unconscionable. You want something that is still fair, but still protects your interests more than anybody else. And every industry is so unique, and every business is so unique. You really need to spend some time, and it's worth the investment to get a contract that is going to be tailored specifically for your needs and practices. And again, it's worth the effort because you're going to be using it so frequently that the investment return is going to be so great on it. So that's the first thing I would do once they're up and running. And in addition to that, you know, oftentimes they'll have similar contracts with vendors or their suppliers that are used on a repeat basis. Okay. So you would want to make sure that those are properly drafted or at least reviewed to make sure that your interests are protected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about things like non-disclosure agreements or protection of intellectual property and things like that?
Right, and that's an excellent thing because maybe you're looking at engaging in a joint venture or strategic partnership, or maybe bringing a new employee on and they want to learn a little bit more. Any circumstance where you're divulging any of your personal business information, you know, be it your trade practices, customer lists, anything like that, finances, you would want what's called a non-disclosure agreement, or often just called a confidentiality agreement, executed by the other side before you start sharing that information. Because if you don't share, if you don't have that in place and they find out, for instance, what your financials are or who your customers are, but they can take that and maybe go to a competitor and use that against you. You know, that's not to say they couldn't do that with the contract in place. You know, a lawyer can't stop somebody from doing something wrong, from breaching a contract or from suing you, but they can try to put you in the best position contractually that if something does go south, you have the proper contract language to protect yourself and your entity.
And at least potentially some means of recourse to...
Right. For instance, it could spell out in that contract what the damages might be, or give you permission and agreed that it's signed off on by the other side that if there is a perceived breach, then they can go to court and have a temporary restraining order issued. So those are very important. And then oftentimes, especially in the context of like an employment agreement and an independent contractor agreement, not only would you have the confidentiality aspect, but you would also have a non-competition and or non-solicitation of, you know, can't solicit my customers or you can't solicit my employees and essentially poach them from me. So a lot of times those three covenants are put in the same document, the non-disclosure, non-solicitation, and non-disclosure, or in the non-competition.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, this is probably a topic you might get a little pushback from some of, you know, some of the folks that you talk to, but really, I guess the way I think about it is this is all about dealing with risk and protecting yourself from potential situations that probably will never occur, but if they do occur, it could be catastrophic for your business. And so while it may seem like sometimes it's you know, it's some detail that you really don't need to get down to or is inconvenient to document, it's certainly... It does carry a lot of importance.
And that's an excellent point. And I often tell clients that in an ideal world, you'll sign this contract, whatever form it may be it a lease or an operating agreement or a customer contract, and everyone performs so well and everyone's being so successful under its terms and everyone's so happy that you never have to refer back to it.
Yeah.
Because once you sign a contract, it doesn't necessarily have to be referred back to. But if there is a problem, that's when you need to pull it out. So that's an excellent point that you brought up.
Well, and it just sets the expectations, you know, and make sure that everybody really understands, you know, what's happening as you're moving into a new venture, whether it's starting that new business or whether it's working on that first project for a customer, or, you know, the product warranty that you might decide to offer, or any of those kinds of things.
Right.
Just sets the expectations and defines what those are.
And it lets the other side know that you're serious and you take your business seriously. And that's a great professional point,
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
You know, and to talk about the risk that you brought up, you know, I got friends who say, you know, you think lawyers are expensive now, wait till you're in court, because yeah. that's when it really gets expensive. So if you can minimize that risk early on, that yeah. would certainly overall help you.
Yeah.
But look at it as insurance is how I tell people.
Okay.
That, you know, hopefully you'll never have to make a claim. Hopefully you'll never have to pull that contract out and refer to its terms. But in the meanwhile, it's peace of mind knowing that you are as protected as you possibly can yeah. under the circumstances.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Any other agreements that you see typically being needed as a business has been around and matures over a period of time?
Sure. You know, one of those things is a lease that or a purchase agreement for real property if they're going to buy a building.
Okay.
That's something that comes up quite frequently. Another item that comes up quite frequently, and they kind of come up in threes, and it's a bit of a generic set of agreements, but they can come up in any given context. But it's a loan or what's called a promissory note. You know, you might need a loan from the bank to buy your building or mm-hmm. to buy equipment to get your yeah. widgets made.
Okay.
Those things are negotiable. Oftentimes, you know, people might see the boilerplate and say, oh, we can't negotiate this. A lot of times you can. You might be surprised.
Okay.
Along with that, especially in today's world and economy, if a business owner is taking out a loan, they're also going to be required by the lender to sign a personal guarantee. Even though they might have that corporate entity or limited liability company in place, that does not protect them from the obligations under a personal guarantee, because that's a separate contract between the person, the okay. shareholder, or mm-hmm. the member, not the entity, and the bank or the, whatever the lender might be.
Hmm. Okay.
Guarantees can often be tailored also. They can be limited to maybe a couple years, just so that the lender can get a comfort level mm-hmm. with the borrower.
Okay.
They can be limited to a certain dollar amount as opposed to the full amount.
Okay.
So there's ways to get creative with those. It's not, I would never sign exactly what's handed to you thinking you don't have any recourse. And then the third part that often goes along with those two is the security agreement, which would be, for instance, what's commonly referred to in the real estate world as a mortgage or a Missouri deed of trust, which is the agreement which allows the lender to essentially foreclose on the property that was used or was purchased with the loaned money
okay.
in order to satisfy the debt in case the payments are stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
You know, even your credit card statements and the receipts that you sign when you go buy something at lunch, for instance, it says I agree to pay in accordance with the terms of the credit card agreement. That credit card agreement often has, well, that's unsecured debt. But again, if you purchased expensive equipment, that's going to be secured. And if you stop making payments, the bank will have the right to foreclose and mm-hmm. take that equipment, sell it to try to pay off that debt. Or the foreclosures you hear about in the paper every day. You know,
yeah.
the bank is saying, okay, you stop making payments, we're going to take that property and sell it and apply it to the debt that you owe us. Now in Missouri, they still have, if for instance, somebody owed $200,000 on a loan for their office building and they stopped making payments because business went bad, and the bank forecloses and they only got $150,000 for the building at the foreclosure sale, the bank can still sue for that extra $50,000 that's still owed. It's called a deficiency. So there's a lot of things that you need to pay attention, make sure that they're, you know, properly drafted okay. to best protect you. And a lot of it always comes down to how much leverage do you have. So somebody's always going to have more leverage. But that's not to say every case is hopeless, that you need to just yeah. sign what's handed to you.
So in that example then, even though you have a corporate veil protecting you, in this case, what you're saying is if the foreclosure only pays off a portion of that from the business aspect, they may still be able to come, because you had to sign as an individual to kind of back that.
As with the guarantee, correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
Well, that's good to know. I've never been in a situation where I've looked at buying property for my business, but I would have never known any of that. So that's fantastic. Okay. Well, I think we've talked a lot about why a lot of these agreements are important. Anything else that jumps to your mind? I mean, I guess one thing that I did want to talk to you a little bit about is just, you know, as you're wrapping up your business and deciding what you want to do with it, either shutting it down or selling it or passing it on to, you know, to your heirs. What about those kinds of agreements?
Sure. So, you know, hopefully, you know, you started your business, you've run it for however long, and you're getting ready to retire or whatever the situation might be. I wouldn't wait till you're at that point. You'd want to plan in advance also. But there's
probably 3 to 5 years if you can, right?
Oh, at least.
Because you want to maximize the value of the business. You want to try to get everything as appealing as possible to...
And that's exactly right. So, you know, you'll have various options at that point. One of the agreements you would need to have, or strongly recommend, is called the buy-sell agreement. And that, again, is a kind of a generic term. There's numerous different ways to achieve it. But that is also an agreement amongst the owners of the company as to what would trigger the right or the obligation for the other partners to purchase your interest in the company. So, for instance, imagine Bob and Tom started a company and ran it for 40 years. They're getting older and concerned about their health. So they might enter into a buy-sell agreement where when one of them passes away, the other either has the right mm-hmm. to purchase the decedent's shares, or perhaps even has the obligation. And there's different reasons you would do it. You know, maybe you want to have it that they have the right to, so that the survivor doesn't get stuck doing business with his partner's widow, who maybe they didn't get along.
Yeah.
They might set it up so that there's an obligation to, in order to provide money for the surviving widow, mm-hmm. you know, upon her husband's death. And this can be funded with life insurance, you know, properly done. So that is part of the exit planning you need to do. In addition to that, there's general succession planning that, you know, perhaps maybe there isn't multiple owners, but there's one owner and he's getting up there, and does he pass it on to his children? Are they even interested in being owners of it? Are they doing something else altogether?
Right.
Do they pass it on to an employee who's been there from day one and loyal and could run the business also? All the factors involved in that could be, what's the value of the company? How do you structure the payment terms?
Mm-hmm.
How do you give up that power? Is it, you know, a little bit of equity over so many years, or is it an outright sale?
Okay.
Or perhaps you put yourself on the market and, you know, competitor buys you, in
yeah.
which case you're going to have either an asset purchase agreement or a stock purchase agreement.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, you know, as a business owner, and I've had my business since 2005, so... You know, over the course of running my business over that time frame, you know, I get unsolicited requests about, hey, you know, we've got somebody who might be interested in buying your business, this, that, and the other. What advice would you have for a business owner like myself who, you know, I mean, first of all, if it's unsolicited, I'm going to be pretty suspicious of it anyway. But you know... There are people who obviously, I think, play like a business broker role where they're, you know, they find businesses that might want to acquire another business and kind of cultivate that relationship. That's not exactly what you do. You're really more on the side of protecting the business entities
mm-hmm.
as those opportunities come and go, right?
Right.
So what words of advice do you have for folks?
In that context, I would recommend, and actually through the whole process, recommend having a great team in place with those relationships in place. And by team, I mean everything from your attorney, your accountant, your financial planner. You know, even earlier on, you're going to need a marketing person and, you know, all the various other roles, client development people. But towards the end, as you're having these discussions on succession planning and selling your business or winding it down, which hopefully you've created enough value that you just don't want to shut it down, that
mm-hmm.
there is somebody else would be interested in purchasing it. But you're going to have your attorney, accountant, and even your financial planner to an extent working closely to maximize the value, minimize the risk, and minimize your tax headache down the road.
Okay. Even if you decide you're working with a business broker in some capacity, I would assume you still would want to work with that team.
Right. And business brokers are great, but they are not lawyers, accountants,
right,
or financial planners necessarily. They are brokers, just the same as a real estate broker. Is focused on finding a business mm-hmm. to sell and then finding a buyer to purchase it.
Okay.
Not so much on the intricacies of what the contract says or how the finances play out or what's it going to do to your retirement account.
Well, I would actually think that a business broker would want to work with a business that already had a good team in place, because that's probably going to drive the value of the business up.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And one of the things that, in the case if they're selling their business towards retirement, one of the things that a potential purchaser will be looking at in what's called a due diligence period, which for lack of a better description is when they're kind of kicking the tires and seeing how things look, they're going to look at what sort of contracts are in place. Are all of their customers under contract?
Mm-hmm.
What do those contracts say? Are they?
What's the value of the
exactly.
customers under contract?
Yeah. Are those contracts for 1 year long, or could they all be canceled mm-hmm. within 30 days and there goes the value of your customers perhaps?
Yeah.
But if they're under contract for several years, well, that could be good because mm-hmm. that's a stream of revenue coming in. What do your corporate books show? Have you kept adequate minutes? Have you dotted your I's, crossed your T's?
Mm-hmm.
All those sorts of things get scrutinized, and obviously then also your financials. Is this a hodgepodge of post-it notes that have been thrown into a file drawer, or is it a legitimate spreadsheet, accounting and regular statements, everything else? So those are very important things that are going to be scrutinized. So you want to make sure everything's above board. Do it as it comes up so you don't get hit with a headache down the road. But
mm-hmm.
And it's also one of those things that I would recommend somebody focus on what they're good at and have the wherewithal to admit, I don't know how to do this, I don't know how to do that, I need to get somebody in place to assist with these things so I can focus on my specialty.
That's right, and that's, I think that's a big challenge for a lot of folks who are small business owners. I mean, part of the appeal is you want to have control and autonomy to do what you want to do, and that's probably why you started your business in the first place, and you probably have a pretty strong idea about what it is you want to do and how you want to do things. But I can't emphasize enough what you just said, that there are good investments of your time and good things to work on, and there are things that you just clearly need to give up and go to somebody who's truly an expert on. So
right, and spend your time doing what you're good at, generating the revenue to justify paying your team.
That's right. So I've had you here for quite a while. I really appreciate your time.
No, absolutely. Thank you.
I guess just one last thing is, do you have any other advice for successful businesses in terms of agreements, or just any other words of wisdom, from the perspective that you bring to the table for us?
Proper planning.
Okay.
Don't wait till the last minute.
Earlier the better?
Earlier the better, and don't be penny wise, pound foolish. You have to go with the mindset that it's an investment. I don't like paying my insurance premiums or my accounting fees or other things that are, at the end of the day, a cost of doing business, but to be successful, I have to do that. That's just really the way to approach it. Don't be penny wise, pound foolish.
Yeah.
That's not to say you need to break the bank. You can get quality work at reasonable prices also. But
That's right. Yeah. So just one last thing. If anybody is interested in trying to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do so?
Sure. My telephone number is 314-610-2526, which is my cell phone, which I use for my business line because I want to be accessible. I pride myself on being accessible and working closely with my clients, so I give them my cell phone all the time, and then my email is mark@millerlawstl.com, which is MUELLERSTL.com.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much, Mark. I really appreciate it. This was awesome.
You bet. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Take care.